Intersections is recorded, produced, and distributed on the territories that have been stolen from the Coast Salish nations of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. The members of the Gender Empowerment Collective seek to dwell within and reckon with these historical truths of dispossession and violence as we dream and curate conversation towards more whole worlds.
Good morning and welcome to Intersections as presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. We're here at CITR 109 FM broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. we host a panel with collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
Welcome back to Intersections. This episode, we are going to be talking about moral panics. My name is Hal, and I'm very excited to be here with everybody today.
My name is Cora. I'm happy to be here to talk about moral panic.
I'm Bella, and I'm really excited to discuss my topic today.
Hi, I'm Adeline, and this seems like a very interesting deep dive into these topics that we covered a little bit in the previous episodes, but today we're really excited to just jump right in and focus on this.
Yeah, so like Adeline said, we have talked a little bit about moral panics in the last episode, specifically in the segment about the Lavender Scare. But to start it off, we just wanted to have a little bit of a discussion about what a moral panic even is. So we have a definition here that a moral panic is a widespread feeling of fear, often an irrational one, that some evil person or thing threatens the values, interests, or well-being of a community or society. And that's kind of a broad jumping off point. So we wanted to refine that down a little bit more, talk about certain instances that maybe are important to us individually, and just talk about how moral panics can be very political, can be very social, can be related to the media, and how there are very strong gendered aspects to a lot of the topics we're talking about today, because moral panics disproportionately have affected women and non-binary folks throughout history. And it really is just a way of impacting marginalized people and giving a social incentive and a social backing for certain political movements that kind of affect marginalized people more.
Okay, so we'll dive into a short introduction on some psych theories that can lead to mass hysteria, and I'll provide like a classic example of mass hysteria. So in 1938, on one October night, actor Orson Welles broadcast a radio adaptation of a classic science fiction story by H.G. Wells. It was called War of the Worlds, and this was a few hours before Halloween. Around 6 million listeners tuned into this program, and this was designed as a phony news broadcast or pre-Halloween joke. So how it all went down was a reporter would interrupt the music at certain periods, and there were like increasingly concerning reports about serial explosions on Mars, like a metal capsule landing on a farm in New Jersey, and like an alien getting out of this capsule. There was like a backdrop of screaming people, and like the whole atmosphere was kind of built to conjure the feeling that there was actually going to be a Martian attack. So by the time the program finished, the listeners were told that there was an army of giant Martians and they were going to invade New York City. Orson Welles made sure to let his audience know at least four times throughout this that this was a reworked version of a science fiction story, but there was still a mass panic. There would be people fleeing into the streets after hearing this, or like hiding in their basements, loading guns, calling the police, preparing for chemical attacks, and all kinds of behavior that seemed irrational. What was found was that even though most listeners didn't panic, there were still thousands of people who did. In all of this emotion and this hysteria, they hadn't exactly bothered to consider other explanations for this broadcast or like other evidence. if they tune into other stations, they would see that there wasn't any such coverage like they were hearing. But in this instance, like, confirmation bias took over. So they were only focusing on one opinion, news reports. And it was kind of like fight or flight response. People probably would freeze. And, you know, this is where the mass hysteria takes over. There's a couple of theories that might explain this kind of phenomenon. So when we look at evolution and social behavior, most of our social processes, they've evolved to help us adapt to our surroundings. Where things can become unhealthy and problematic is if these influences cause us to become blind and unquestioning. You have that in cases of conformity and obedience. Like, there's different levels of that. But as long as we have critical thinking, we can somehow, we're more able to transcend these types of things. When it comes to the previous example, there's a tendency to kind of attribute like this behavior to other people's characteristics. People are more likely to assume that people are reacting this way because of their own characteristics, like their personality or their own attitudes or intelligence. So people can underestimate the effect of social influences. This is called the fundamental attribution error. Another important point is that we can naturally compare our personal reactions with other people's reactions. So that's one way that we evaluate beliefs, attitudes, and abilities. So that's called a social comparison theory. And in uncertain situations, like the example that was provided, it's natural to seek others' opinions on how to behave and react. Like, this helps us, especially in that kind of new situation where we're unprepared. But as mentioned previously, it's important to be aware of the far-reaching effects of these kinds of influences. So now, to define mass hysteria, usually in psychology, we could define this as like an outbreak of unreasonable behavior. And now this is going to give like some COVID vibes, but like it soon spreads like an epidemic. And then before you know it, it might get out of control. And so if it really gets out of control, then it can lead to like collective delusions. Some other things that we could look at, like on how this kind of phenomenon can build up over time, is there's like a classic study on conformity called the Ash paradigm. Here you would have like 8 subjects, including yourself, participating, but the other subjects are confederates that are hired by the researcher. So they have like certain opinions on things already. Here you would like compare one standard line to 3 other lines. And those other confederates are trained to say out loud the wrong answer. Since you would always be the 5th person that's called, by the time it gets to you, it really like reflects the effect of other people's opinions. What they found was 75% of people, when they heard the other people giving these wrong answers, the effect of the conformity kind of had a huge influence. So 75% of people ended up conforming to these incorrect norms. There were some people who stuck to their guns no matter what. Like, they knew that the line that they were seeing wasn't the same, and they like stuck to that. But yeah, it's important to kind of consider like the overwhelming effect of this conformity on people. Even when they went further and did some imaging studies on the brain with fMRI, it revealed that our own perceptions of reality can be affected by social pressure. And that's reflected in like activity in the parietal and occipital lobes, and that can affect our visual perception. This kind of study, people were asked to mentally rotate figures, but they had 4 other people. You were told that these 4 other people were making the same judgments as you, and those are like pre-programmed judgments. They found that here too, with conformity, 41% of the time there was conformity. Even though this kind of conforming behavior can produce anxiety in people, because there's still a tendency to doubt this kind of overarching unanimous opinion when you know it's not correct. So there's like some amygdala activity, and that reflects like anxiety triggers in your brain. People underneath, they might still be nervous while they are conforming. So that's quite interesting, because underneath, some people know that the opinion might not be correct, but it's just social influence prompts them to still conform. Lastly, there is a theory called groupthink. Sometimes group unanimity is emphasized to the point where critical thinking is not at the forefront, and that can influence sound decision-making. So there's instances like that where project managers who were responsible for the Space Shuttle Challenger flight, they hadn't exactly listened to some opinions from NASA that it might be too cold to launch. And so that's like one example of groupthink. Not all psychologists agree that groupthink always leads to bad decisions, just overconfident ones. There are instances of groupthink that lead to group decisions that are not that damaging. Like all the previous theories, it's good to consider like alternate evidence too. The last part of the theories that might explain how mass hysteria can form is how groupthink can lead to the formation of cults. And here, like, we usually think of a group of people that are really intensely devoted to this cause, but they're devoted to the point where they're not really questioning certain beliefs. And like, even though members may mostly be like psychologically normal, sometimes the leaders might not be. So they might like discourage questioning of beliefs and also try to disconnect members from the outside world so that they won't have access to other opinions. I don't have particular questions since this is an introduction, but it would be cool as we go through everyone's topics today to have your opinion on how much you think these theories might influence the phenomenon that you're going to cover. With that, I'll turn it over to Bella, who will introduce us to her topic for today.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial, open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Hey, what's wrong?
I want to go to therapy, but I can't afford it.
Well, did you know there's a show on CITR where you can get free therapy every other week?
Really? What's it called?
It's called Therapy Hour, and it airs every other Tuesday at 6 p.m.
You mean I can get free therapy every 2 weeks just by listening to the radio?
That's right, and it doesn't even cost you a dime.
Wow, I won't have to cry anymore.
Actually, crying is pretty good for you. I learned that by listening to Therapy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, because everyone needs therapy.
But not everyone can afford it.
Okay, so moving right along, my topic is more of, I guess you could say, like an iconic one. I feel like a lot of people are familiar with this. And in general, it's about how music could be considered a moral panic, but I specifically wanted to talk on something that we could call like the war on rock music. So I was inspired to discuss this topic when I watched a Vox kind of mini documentary on YouTube about like the satanic rise of the parental content label that you see on a lot of album covers. And it kind of does a deep dive into why we need that and how that came about and kind of like what led up to that. So yeah, this is just like a bit of a summary and a bit of my own opinions on just something that I found really interesting. So the first thing that I wanted to talk about is kind of like the overall theme, which is kind of about like adult or parental governmental pushback on popular music trends that were most common in like the late 70s and early 80s. So I'm talking about rock music and also heavy metal music. So really, in essence, this moral panic was started and whipped up by the media, which framed rock music as like a reference to the occult or like to Satan, because that is somewhat of a popular kind of lyrical theme, like making references to Satan or hell, like in rock music or heavy metal. And then a group of politicians' wives created what was called the Parents Music Resource Center, which was kind of just like them saying that this kind of music was not appropriate for their children, and it was turning their children into, you know, doing terrible things and having all these bad and radical ideas. And eventually, but we'll get back to it later, they took this whole idea to court, and they were the ones that created the parental advisory label. But before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit more about like the origins of that. So basically the PMRC for short, claims that the music of the 80s was harming their teenage children. And then as we also saw the rise of MTV starting from 1981, it kind of made this more accessible. And then not only was it just audio, kind of like the lyrics, but it was also visuals because it was music videos. And then the PMRC also created what was called the Filthy 15, which is just like a list of their top 15 most terrible, most satanic titles of 1985. And they were proposing like a rating system. So it was rating based on violence or drugs and alcohol, or like the references to the occult, which is kind of what we're going to talk most about. And then this is a media craze that we could call the satanic panic, which is, I guess, like my main point of what I wanted to talk about today. So obviously, as we kind of touched on, the main point of this argument was that rock artists were using their songs consciously to push the ideas of Satan onto the young people of America. And these claims were, maybe not to my surprise, were led by groups of evangelists. So primarily like the Christian church was behind like telling all this to the media. So it kind of stirred the media into a frenzy, even though some of the claims from the evangelists were totally baseless, and they were kind of just making like these crazy claims so people would come to watch them talk and it would like make them more money. So then next I want to talk about one of their main kind of things that they were claiming, and this is called backward masking, which is like a phenomenon that if you take your record out of your record player in the 80s and you flip it over and play it backwards, that the song would like play a secret message that was somehow influenced by the words of Satan. And then like, even though we only listen to the record forwards, like to hear the song, you could still subliminally process the message of Satan. And then a really famous example of the subliminal messaging is from Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, which is like, if you flip the record over and you play a certain part of the song, apparently it sounds like they're saying, "My sweet Satan." But it was quite a stretch. So like whenever the media was talking about it, they would kind of like say, "Oh, listen to this. It sounds like My Sweet Satan," in order to kind of like prep the listeners for like what they wanted to hear. And it reminds me a lot of, I'm not sure how many people will remember, but in like 2018, there was a really viral audio clip that was like, "Do you hear Laurel or do you hear Yanny?" And it was like, depending on what you were thinking of in your head was like what you heard. So it was like, "Oh, I hear Laurel, I hear Yanny, or I hear both." So it kind of like makes me think of how it's whatever you want to hear. And then in California, they proposed legislation. The artist would have to like include a label on their track that, to say that it included hidden subliminal messages, but that wasn't passed. And then another claim that was made by the media was trying to kind of do like, it's kind of like a correlation that is not equal causation kind of case. It was attempting to link the rising suicide rates among teenage boys to like listening to rock or heavy metal lyrics, to say that like the genre induced Satanism and caused them to do like these unspeakable satanic acts. And this created a really powerful negative image for the heavy metal artists. Like, obviously that's not what they're trying to do. Like, we see that now because the moral panic has subsided, but it was just really sad kind of to think about all of the backlash that they were facing, which kind of just like adds like another layer onto how the media was reacting already. So then to circle back to that court hearing that we were talking about, the parents, kind of like the parents club that I was talking about earlier, created the parental advisory label. And this was widely adopted starting in the 90s. And there was like a lot of pushback from the rock and heavy metal artists. And they like created joke warning labels or like purposeful backward messaging, and like included that on their album covers, kind of like as a, you know, thanks for doing that sort of thing, because a lot of their music obviously couldn't sell as much because the parental advisory content was pulled from shelves of like big box stores. And then nowadays, I guess we could talk about an example of that, which is like Kendrick Lamar's album, like Damn, where it has like a lot of backwards messaging just on purpose, just kind of like as like a funny, like as a joke. But yeah, that's kind of a popular moral panic that I wanted to talk about. And some starter discussion questions that I have are like, what do we think about the explicit content label? Do we still need it? Should we revisit it? Like, is it really helpful?
Yeah, I think that it's definitely based on this history, something that we need to revisit, because I think having some sort of conversation about what is in a piece of music before you listen to it, I think is really helpful, especially because people are going to react to things differently. So I still think it is really beneficial to have some sort of something with trigger warnings and things along those lines where we are discussing what's in a piece of music before you just dive right into it. However, I think taking this approach where there's one body that unilaterally gets to decide this is good music or bad music for children to listen to is really where that issue is. And if we can kind of do it in a more collaborative process, have different people kind of weighing in, that could make it a lot more beneficial. Because I think another big part of this whole moral panic is that rock music was something during this time period that really subverted gender norms. So because so much of this was based in kind of evangelicalism, there was this hesitancy to engage with things that did go against the gender binary. And then you see like Freddie Mercury was typically someone who was kind of said to have these messages in his music. And Another One Bites the Dust is kind of one of the main examples people bring up. And it may be related to the fact that he so prominently went against the gender binary. And this was something that was really gaining widespread acceptance. And I think some of these religious groups were not really understanding that and weren't resonating with it. So they were trying to move against this music by saying that therefore it's satanic because it doesn't fit into the cultural norms. So you also, when there's this one body that's making all the decisions, you have to look at what may be their purposes as well in doing that.
I was growing up during this particular phase. I was a young kid, but I still saw quite a bit of it tagging around into the 2000s. And I definitely had friends whose parents were like, you're not allowed to listen to any of those rock musics or the hip hop because it'll make you rebel against me. And I can't accept that, which is a whole thing that we could get into, is like the idea that this music causes social disruption and like rejection of hierarchies, which might be a good thing in my humble opinion. But it was definitely a major problem hanging around my neighborhood and my childhood, was seeing people being like, this music obviously causes kids to die, or they'll join gangs, or they'll get into fights. And a lot of the problems that I saw these kids going through were not stemming from the music, but the social conditions that they were in, like getting bullied or being socially ostracized, or just growing up far, far away from everyone else and having to deal with that isolation, which is not very good for kids, or being like forcibly removed from your friend groups, led to people listening to this music because it was something you resonated with. And I blame the parent, which is another big argument that I experienced. Like Twisted Sister's lead singer, whose name escapes me, went to court over this particular matter because one of his songs was put on the Filthy 15, as mentioned, and he won the court case. And it was very much, if you are having these problems with your kids, maybe it's your fault and not the music. And I wish I remembered more about the case because it's very interesting. And it looks like Bella is going to be right all over that. So I'll turn it over.
So yeah, I just have a couple of points to add from my research based on what everybody was kind of saying. But first, to touch on what Cora said, the lead singer of Twisted Sister is called Dee Snider. And he was in that court case with, I think, two other like famous heavy metal rock artists that were trying to defend, saying that this like label was like an infringement on their free speech, which personally I agree with because it's like music. And then a whole underlying topic of the court case was like, if the parents are claiming that this music is harming their children's ears, why are they buying the records and playing it for their children when it's so very clear, like on the record, that this is like 18 plus kind of content? That was one of the arguments from the like the parents group, saying that she bought one of these records for her 11-year-old daughter. It was a Prince record, which talks about like some inappropriate for young ears, like sexual acts. And she was saying that her daughter was like appalled, and everyone kind of in the audience and people that are going over it now are like, well, why did you buy this for your daughter when you know of the content and you know the lyrics? Like, why didn't you kind of like pre-screen this before telling, you know, like your daughter or letting them listen to it? So it's kind of like, is it the parents' fault or is it the artist's fault? Because they're just kind of trying to like do their own thing. But yeah, also to touch on what Cora was mentioning, after this whole kind of like business with heavy metal was over or had subsided, it kind of immediately started turning to like rap music, because that was kind of like an up and coming sort of genre of music. And then obviously, like in a predominantly African-American kind of like field, a lot of the white evangelists are like, I don't know if I want my children listening to this. So it kind of just like turned from one thing to another, denoting that like rap music was suggesting violence or like violence against the police. But yeah, that's just a couple of things that I wanted to add. Very good point.
I remember when the Enter the 36 Chambers by Wu-Tang Clan first got out into my tiny little shitty neighborhood. Like one of my friend's parents had driven into town and was like, here, have $20 to just go buy whatever. And that album made it back to us. And we obviously burned a bunch of copies and it got handed around because this was like the 90s and 2000s. I can't remember exactly what year, but Napster era sort of situation. And it was a life-changing album for me. It really instilled in me a lot of anti-authoritarian beliefs, but it also caused a small riot between the parents because they found out that we were listening to Wu-Tang Clan, which was at the time like in the news as being very violent against the police, and rap was and like getting big out here in like the PNW, and especially in like little isolated towns where you have hicks that are transitioning. And now like hip hop and rap are very big in like the hick communities that I've been from. But before that, it was all like country and outlaw country that was like the anti-establishment music, but it was acceptable anti-establishment music. I don't know what that means necessarily in reality, but that transition period, there was a lot of grinding of gears and a lot of fist fights on lawns over whose parent or whose child was at fault for letting Wu-Tang Clan into the community.
Yeah, that would definitely be an interesting aspect to explore in future episodes. Like, what is the role of the artist? If parents are clearly seeing that there's an 18 plus advisory, but they still choose to consume the content with their children, like, what's the responsibility of the artist to the world? And if they've already explicitly stated that, then what's the responsibility of the consumer then? So yeah, that really brought up some great points.
Okay, so for our next topic, I wanted to talk a little bit about a more historical example of a moral panic, so a little bit less modern. I wanted to touch on the Salem witch trials and how those are an example of a moral panic that takes away some of the political and media aspects that we talk about a lot with modern moral panics. So I'm not going to go a ton into the details of the Salem witch trials because I think pretty much everyone is very familiar with the broad strokes of it, but it took place in 1692 through a little bit in 1693 in colonial Salem Village, Massachusetts, which isn't to be confused with Salem, Massachusetts. It was actually a separate, much smaller community. And Salem, Massachusetts became the modern city. Salem Village was a completely different community at this time. So I first want to talk about why this even is a moral panic, because it doesn't fit into a lot of the modern kind of definitions of this. Because generally, moral panics take place when there's a cultural value that people generally accept as important, and then something else is then equated with this cultural value in order to instill fear in people. So one kind of modern example is the war on Christmas. Then you have the Starbucks cups, don't have anything to do with Christmas. Then you have this broader fear that Christian values are disappearing in American society and things along those lines. And then when that became equated with the Starbucks cups, now everyone's reacting to the cups as almost like a proxy for this broader social conversation. So that generally is the case in moral panics. And they become particularly damaging when that social proxy is related to an identity or group of people. So for example, the Salem witch trials, the fear about Puritan gender roles became equated with women in general, and the identity of being a woman and being a woman who didn't fit into these gender roles became equated with the entire idea of Puritan values disappearing, which was a major concern during the time period. So this moral panic, though, is interesting because it doesn't hold a lot of the political and media elements that we usually think about it, because generally when we see this coupling of kind of an idea and then a broader social value, there's some media element to it or some political element to it. Like the Lavender Scare that we talked about last time, it was a concentrated effort by McCarthy and by the media to pair up the idea of queer people with communism and to make this kind of witch hunt. However, the witch trials, it was a lot more abstract than that. It was during this time period, because Salem Village was such a small community, there really wasn't a political structure in place. The courts were very small, which is why it did get out of hand in the same way. There was no media to speak of. There was no colonial government. So it really just was kind of this pure mob mentality, kind of like Adeline was talking about, and this very like emotional response for kind of this fear of a wider threat from the community. And I think during this time period, because there wasn't that organized government, people felt the need to defend themselves, to take care of themselves. So they resorted to things like this. And afterwards, this one was very different because when that political structure did come in later years, the witch trials were almost universally condemned because this isn't something we normally see with moral panics. Usually there's some element of some groups of people who will always continue to agree with moral panic. However, the Salem witch trials, people universally say, no, this is a bad thing. This was wrong. That a lot of the people who were involved with it apologized. The people who were still in prison were pardoned. The governor came in and fixed some things, fixed the court system, dissolved portions of the court. And actually the families of the people who were killed received significant reparations. So this was one, as soon as a political system moved in, it actually fixed the issue, which I think goes contrary to a lot of our kind of thoughts about modern moral panics. So on that note, I wanted to ask everyone their thoughts about how this moral panic might act as more of a case study of a more social approach to moral panic rather than political, that like we've been talking about, and how really those individual psychological aspects such as anxiety or such as just a general feel of like feeling of uncertainty can play into moral panics and how that maybe differs from things like the lavender scare that we've talked about.
I think that in the kind of society or societal structure that you're talking about, kind of like with a lack of government and more of just like a people, you know, people run area. I kind of think it obviously, like you were saying, like creates like a hive mind kind of structure where they kind of all go together because there is no one overriding authority. There's like nothing that you should take, whose word you should take as law, that you kind of just like go with whatever everyone else is going with, even if you're not really sure, you know, like if that's right or if that's important, which I think is kind of a reason why it dissolved so quickly when government moved in, like, as you said, because there was finally kind of like a word that is law and a word that you know to agree with, that you can prove that is right. But like when there's no form of government, it's a lot harder to kind of divide between what is right and what is wrong. And then it's easier kind of just to go with what people are saying rather than like, you know, having to be the one to start something completely from scratch when there's already such an established opinion.
Yeah, I think it's also like people fear the loss of control. Like they're used to being the dominating social force in a society, and any threats to that and any changes to how society functions often makes people very afraid, because now they are, their whole way of life is being threatened, and they don't know what the social order is going to be like when that changes. And this like emplacement of a government system is putting into place a system of control that everyone agreed on. And so it's not just like each individual person is like, oh, this is what I think right is, and this is how I think justice should be enacted. Not that that doesn't still happen with all of us forever and ever. But you can look to something that's concrete and say, ah, I agreed to this, and therefore things are still under control. Whereas before, and this is like, I think a continuation into today, where things are like, stuff is changing beyond my control, and stuff is changing in ways that run counter in some way to what I experienced when I was young, and therefore it is wrong.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that brings up some interesting points about how the witch trials started in the first place, because I think a lot of people think of the witch trials and think that it was women who were targeted, and it's kind of implied like by men in the community. But actually the first allegations against the people who ended up being tried and killed for witchcraft came from other women, because there was a group of young girls who were falling sick. It was like violently sick, and a lot of people didn't know how to explain that. And in hindsight, we've done research on it. It could have been contamination of the food. There are lots of different theories about why this happened. But in the time, they just didn't know why this was happening. And that's where those allegations of witchcraft first came from, was from these young girls who were getting really sick and were very scared. And then once people started getting tried and charged, they then said, okay, I plead guilty, but then I'm going to also inform on other people. So it kind of became this domino effect of people were trying to save themselves. They were scared. It was uncertain. So they were therefore kind of furthering this issue. And it just became a system where people were kind of throwing people under the bus in order to help themselves. And it really was based out of that uncertainty that started with just a simple thing of a bunch of people were getting very sick.
Yeah, the thought of the food contamination was ergot poisoning, which grows on wheat and oats. And it causes serotonin syndrome, which can increase sleep paralysis. So if anyone's experienced sleep paralysis, it's all of your muscles lock down and you're partially awake and your brain freaks out because you can't move. Same reason why you don't move and act out your dreams when you're just normally asleep. So it produces something to explain why you're being held in place. So often witches, demons, insects in some cases are holding you down. And it's very scary. I've had a handful of times and it is not my favorite experience of all time. And that could be attributed to people's like growing fear as it starts getting more and more of this ergot into their system bit by bit by bit. They're having more of these serotonin syndromes, which sleep paralysis, but it also causes hallucinations, panic, stress responses. And like, if you get bad enough, you just hallucinate. You just start seeing stuff for fun. Well, for your brain's fun, I guess. It's not very fun anyways. And so people were experiencing all this fear and all of these things that were completely feasible in the idea of the time, like what a witch could do to you. And so they needed an explanation. They needed a place to put this. And obviously they didn't know about ergot poisoning, although it was known about for like thousands of years before, and it was lost. Like I think 500 years before that, we started to lose the knowledge of what ergot poisoning was because people used to do it recreationally for reasons. And then you get situations like people saying, oh, this person I don't like is holding me down because there's a social priming of, oh, there's witches here and there are people we know. Therefore, this person that I don't like is going to be the reason why I had a nightmare effectively. And so that just builds it and builds it and builds it and creates more of a framework where people understand their fears to be part of a system because, you know, things not making any sense doesn't work for people's brains very well.
Well, I think this is a really interesting example of a moral panic. It's kind of cool, in my opinion, I guess, to think about what moral panic was like before modern day, like modern times, like in the 1600s. That's a long time ago. And society was so vastly different, obviously, as you're talking about. But I think that's something we could kind of, I guess, a line between old moral panic, so to speak, and like modern moral panic would be that it's so easily used as like a scapegoat, I would say, just for like things that people don't want to believe. Or like I was thinking to, in my example, how it was used to explain like rising suicide rates in teenage boys. And then here, like it's used to explain, like obviously Court was saying, ergot, I believe, poisoning. Just kind of like things that you don't want to explain to other people. You can just be like, oh, it's this, oh, it's that. And then like all of a sudden everybody is like, you know, all stirred up into like something crazy. And then it just gets so blown out of proportion. But yeah, I just think that's really interesting to think about how moral panic or the idea of it has changed, but it also like has not changed.
Yeah, just to wrap this up before we move on to Cora's segment, I completely agree with what Bella's saying, and I think it's very interesting to compare the witch trials to the Lavender Scare, like we talked about last time, because the Lavender Scare is something that I, growing up in the U.S., didn't learn about until my senior year of high school, even though it was a major issue. It had huge legal implications, social implications, and it really was this modern moral panic that was a big part kind of fostered by the government and by the media. And yet the Salem witch trials, as important as they were, they happened in a very small area, and yet they're a major part of our cultural conversation. Even the phrase like a witch hunt, which we often use when talking about moral panics or even talking about the Red Scare and the Lavender Scare, is kind of a major part of our conversations about this. And I think there are things to be said there about kind of the targeting of queer people and how that isn't something that's taught in schools. But I agree with Bella, it's very interesting to look at kind of moral panic separated from the media, because sometimes these media panics just aren't recognized in the same way as a moral panic. They're just taken as normal.
A Tribe Called Red is the hallucination with their new record, One More Saturday Night, featuring Javier Mighty, Tanya Tagak, and more, out now.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
All right. And to round us out, I wanted to bring up the Dungeons and Dragons and general tabletop, because they weren't differentiated colloquially back in the 80s and 90s. And not to say that Dungeons and Dragons is free of any issues or many issues or a lot of issues, but the issues that were brought up in the 80s and 90s in the Satanic Panic, which was aligned with the like war against rock and roll and that sort of stuff, they were parents broadly, and lots of evangelical groups were very afraid that role-playing games were making kids be violent and murdering each other or committing suicide or practicing Satanism or witchcraft. They were joining gangs or any sort of social subversion. Some people were claiming that playing D&D made you do homosexual activities. For reasons completely beyond me, like, I've done the research and I was there for it, at least part of it. And I didn't understand where they were getting these examples from, because they were all fake. Or they found people who like had stood next to a book of D&D at one point, and then that was obviously the cause. And I know that it is in part, as I was talking before, people like to rationalize social problems and rationalize why they're losing control, besides the fact that time eventually shifts and people change and society evolves. The fear of Dungeons and Dragons started before Dungeons and Dragons really became a thing, with the idea that fantasy as a genre was immoral, corrupting, and generally evil. Say Tolkien is a great example of people, including academics, saying that, oh, this is escapism, oh, it's like disgusting. It's been a common word thrown around. This is pedophilia wasn't a common claim of what we understand to be fantasy now was seen as, and that reading fantasy novels or writing them especially would lead you to do either try and act out what happened in those novels, which is a whole other conversation, or was a subliminal message of what you wanted people to do, which is subliminal messaging, backmasking, all again ties back to the general Satanic Panic. And I'm going to tie this back to my own past, because I had a handful of friends whose parents were all part of the same church, who were explicitly banned from spending time with me personally, but also spending time with anyone who associated with like fantasy genre, or they knew what D&D was another one. Is it like, if you hear them say the word D&D, you're not allowed to hang out with them? They didn't stop them, but it was hanging over all of our hangouts. Like, we had to go, if we wanted like play together outside, we'd have to find some place that was secluded away from a road, which is, you know, suspect behavior if you're known for being a D&D person, like the social ostracization and the need for stealth to play a board game effectively enforced those fears that people were like becoming socially subversive or becoming parts of gangs or whatever. And I never really saw it become as big an issue as I saw it on the news, where people would like go through bookstores and burn all of the D&D books, or they'd rummage through their kids' rooms looking for role-playing books or fantasy books. This started to fade out with Harry Potter, by the way. Like, Harry Potter was very much a big moral panic. I don't know if anyone remembers that. Yeah. But that's when it started to taper off, with was Harry Potter. And it was a very strange experience because my parents never had any problems with any of this stuff. My dad and mom are huge nerds. I love you. My dad had me reading fantasy novels when I was like 3 or 4. He'd like read out The Hobbit to me because I was not that good at reading at that age. And so going from that sort of experience out into the rest of my hick town and seeing how people thought that, oh, if you read The Hobbit, you're gonna join the Bloods and get shot in LA for some reason. it was a real experience. All right, I'm gonna turn it to the floor.
Something that I want to talk about is kind of like a theme of what you were saying. It's kind of how like genre is used as a means of control. So especially like fantasy, obviously, because that's like the whole point of what we're discussing here. But I just think that it's really, I don't know, it makes me think of, you mentioned the Harry Potter book, and it makes me think of how the Harry Potter, I think it's like the first one or maybe some of the series are banned in certain countries or were banned in certain countries because of their fantasy elements, which are cited as like going against traditional values like of the state or of the religion in the state, notably like a couple places like in the Middle East, I feel like, are amongst those that have banned the first Harry Potter book. So I think it's interesting as a means of controlling like imagination, because I feel like when you read fantasy books, like your imagination is what is able to kind of like make the world, which sounds really cheesy, but it's just like, you know, like you have to use your imagination. And when you're reading a fantasy book, it's obviously like it's not real life. Like you have to kind of like put some things together in your head. But I think that by banning that, like that's such an effective means of like kind of like taking control and like subverting, I guess, people's ability to kind of like create in their head or like to be their own person. Yeah, I don't know, just kind of what that reminds me of. But yeah, very good points.
Yeah, I think the cultural conversation around D&D has also changed a lot, even in the past 2 or 3 years, because when I was a kid, I heard about D&D kind of casually, and it was always kind of saying D&D is evil and you should never play it and things like that. And then I think it's probably during COVID, you have this kind of growth in actual play podcasts of D&D where people are just playing D&D with their friends and taping it. And then there are shows like The Adventure Zone, which becomes this huge cultural phenomenon. It's this very popular story that people follow, not even for the game, but just as a piece of media in and of itself. And I think that really taught a lot of people about D&D. That's certainly how I was introduced to it in a more positive lens. I also think it's interesting that even though kind of it was proposed as like this, it promotes homosexual activities, it still has been claimed a lot by the queer community. It was my queer friends who introduced me to it, and I don't know where that came from. I don't know if that's kind of a form of reclamation that we still listen to D&D podcasts and enjoy playing D&D, but it's now like a lot of my queer friends, we do talk about things like The Adventure Zone and podcasts like that, because now it's kind of this friendship building thing as opposed to something that people kind of condemn in that way.
Yeah, to call all the way back up to Bella's segment, I was talking about how people who exist on the margins of a community often turn to escapism and also rock music as an expression of that marginalization or rejection from the community. So although none of my friends were actually out in high school, the ones of us that did play role-playing games were almost exclusively queer because it was significantly better than existing in a rural town while being queer. And that continued to be the case for my whole life. Like, as I grew up into an adult, it was always like my queer friends or my friends who existed on the margins of society who were most interested in doing role-playing games, because, you know, you can make a much cooler world and be a much cooler person in a role-playing game than what you have to exist in at the time. And I had a point that I was going somewhere with. What was it? Oh, yeah. It was one hell of a shock when I, like, I think it was in 2014, 2015, I think it was, when I first noticed that there were D&D podcasts and that they were starting to get popular. Because before that point, it was profoundly uncool and very few people talked about it. And it still carried some social stigma, like, oh, nerds do that. Oh, losers do that. Oh, like, people who don't belong do tabletop role playing. And I saw, like, cool people on the TV TM playing tabletop games. And I was like, what the hell is happening? Who invited y'all in? And now I'm very happy that it has happened, because there's been a renaissance in tabletop games. There's been a renaissance in tabletop games where you see, like, explicitly queer tabletop games coming out, like Sword Lesbians. Oh, my beloved heart, Sword Lesbians. Or I'm blanking all of the names right now, but I promise you there are so many out there. You just need to look for them. Like, getting to have that be an explicit part of the rules and not something that you could just be allowed to do inside a role-playing game was a shock to the system, and a very happy shock to the system, because, I mean, it's nice to not exist on the margins all the time. And also, as a fantasy writer, fantasy's cool, kids. You should really get into fantasy. You should really, like, dive deep into working in your own imagination and seeing how far you can push your mind, because, A, it's cool. It's a cool thing to do now, but also it can teach you a lot about yourself and what you want the world to be like if you get the time to sit down and design your own, and, like, what you think problems are and what you think you should be critical of in the world can be found through fantasy.
So I just wanted to add, I guess, like, my two cents to this. I've personally never played Dungeons & Dragons, but I've always wanted to, which I think really says something about the state of the world, like, when I was growing up. So when it was like 2014, 2015, I was like 11 and 12. So I was like still really little. And that's like when you start to, I guess, like, grow into yourself and, like, you're exposed to stuff. And then it's like obviously like the rise of social media, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So I think that it was never portrayed negatively to me, like, in my entire life. And, like, even up to now, like, I think it's so cool. I've always wanted to do it. It's just, like, you know, never really had the opportunity. But I think that you see it a lot in, like, the media now. A notable example is the, like, the first season, or, like, I don't know, at some point in the show, like, Stranger Things, which just came out recently, which I'm going to be watching. But I know that's something that they play. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. Like, I wish I could be building my own world. So I think it's just interesting to think about, like, how different things are now and kind of like how much progress that represents, because I think of it more as now like a game for everyone. It's just like some people like it, some people don't, not as like, oh, that's a game for nerds, or like, you know, uncool people, or it's a lame kind of thing. I just like, I think everyone kind of thinks of it more positively now. It's just like for some people, not for others.
You brought it up. There are a lot of lightweight systems out there. I'm just going to plug them, like the Lasers and Feelings system. It has two stats, Lasers and Feelings. It involves one dice, and it's a very simple one shot. So if you're ever looking to, like, get your feet in the pool of role-playing games, Lasers and Feelings is a great way to get into it very quickly. Maybe we could do an episode where we play a game of Lasers and Feelings or something. That'd be a lot of fun. I've DM'd a handful of games for it. But yeah, it's really exciting to see people like growing up in a culture or becoming adults in a culture where it's actually accepted to play these tabletop role-playing games, and see that moral panic pretty much subsided, because it was pervasive, especially like rock music is very popular now. It's all over the place. And I don't really see many people like railing against it like I did when I was younger. And I'm proud of us now that we're all the adults and we get to be in charge. Getting to undo these moral panics and see people grow from them has been an incredible journey. Listen to rock and roll, kids. All right. Does anyone want to wrap up?
Yeah, like I think developing a great imagination also aids in critical thinking, because how are you supposed to consider other points of view if you can't think beyond your own sphere and like extend it in many different directions? Before more research came out about video games helping in that sphere, you know, you had all these archaic notions about what these games do. So just some additional thoughts on previous sections. Okay, so for the Salem witch trials, that part about largely targeting older women who didn't fit into certain puritanical gender roles, that part must have played a lot into why we still describe this phenomenon as witch hunts sometimes, because just that image gets really stamped into people's heads. Like, it wasn't just men who were quote unquote hunting these people to be hanged as witches. Like, there were a lot of women doing it too. So it was like a widespread kind of phenomenon among various genders. Just that whole thought of like, if, when people are existing on the margins of society, like Cora had mentioned, and then they get marginalized even more when even just a small shred of their behavior doesn't seem to conform to like the overall group. It just reminds me of terms like trial by social media, where like in a certain community, if you have someone that's more socially prominent, they could just, I don't know, find some, even the smallest fault in people and then build some argument around like their witches and then go on this massive hunt. And then this whole phenomenon explodes. So yeah, that just kind of also reminded me about like policing of music too. There's this term called implicit egotism effects, which finds that people are more positively disposed towards people that are like them. So if you have certain authority figures that are telling you certain things, like we have with the rock music and we have with the games, and then farther back when we had these people that were existing on the margins of society, but they had some what were perceived as odd behaviors, or like their lifestyle was a bit different from the overall group, then you have this massive shift and everything explodes.
Thank you for listening to Intersections. This episode, we talked about moral panics, and we talked about a couple examples of moral panics that we've seen in our own lives or just things we've seen throughout history, just to talk a little bit more about what that is and why it's important. And I think there really are those gendered elements like we talked about of moral panics. So I think this is a really important topic to think about more, even with modern news media and how we interact and what maybe some modern moral panics can be that are still going on today. So thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to talking to you again. Thank you for listening to Intersections, presented by CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective at 101.9 FM. We can always be reached by email at genderempowerment@citr.ca or on Instagram at genderempowerment_CITR for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. You can find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Our theme song is provided by John Allison Weiss. Tune in again in 2 weeks on Tuesday at 10 a.m. to catch our next episode.